Thank you. I'm very honored and very happy to be here. As far as the stories are concerned, I think you should catch him at wine, not at tea. Then the stories will be more interesting, I guess. But I will try to entertain you as best as I can. Now, of course, this area of hyperbolic conservation laws is an area that's filled with contrasts. For instance, it's a very old area, and at the same time, there's a lot of activity nowadays. It's fair to say that over the past 10 years, we have seen dramatic progress, but at the same time, it's fair to say that the main problems are still open. It is a somewhat isolated area in the sense that people in that area have developed their own techniques, very specialized techniques, not the standard techniques or PDEs, but at the same time, it's fair to say that perhaps out of desperation, people have borrowed or have drawn all sorts of techniques from analysis and so on into this area. So it is somewhat a somewhat strange area, but perhaps for all these reasons also interesting. Now I was planning to talk about dramatic or recent developments in the area, and certainly it would be possible to do that because there are such developments, but this is a general audience. These developments are rather technical in nature, so I thought that I should change a little bit direction, and I shall talk not about recent developments, but about future developments. In other words, what is that we don't know about this area, right? So this I will try to do, and today's lecture will be rather general. I will try to bring you into the ambience of the area, if possible, sort of to see some of the concepts, some of the very general concepts, perhaps familiar to most of you in one way or another. Tomorrow's lecture will be more focused, more specific. I will have to use transparencies tomorrow, but today I will use the blackboard, and I will go slow. So first of all, I want to explain what is a conservation law and why conservation laws are ubiquitous in mathematical physics, in analysis, and so on. And I will start being very general somehow. So here I will have some kind of open subset of RK. So RK will be my ambient space here. And in applications to mathematical physics, of course, these conservation laws arise both in statics, in equilibrium, and in dynamics. When dealing with statics, RK will be physical space, so K will be 1, 2, or 3. In dynamics, RK will be space-time, so K will be 2, 3, or 4. So the typical point, let's say, will be denoted, let's say, by capital X. And I will distinguish subsets, bounded, open-bounded subsets, let's say, D, of X with Lipschitz boundary. So in particular, I can consider at most points on the boundary of D, unit normal N, pointing outwards. Now, I will be assuming that on X, first of all, I have a signed Radon measure. Which is called the production measure. In other words, if I have any one of these domains, D, the value of P at D will give me the production of whatever quantity is balanced or conserved. And also with any D is associated a countably additive function, defined on Borel subsets of the boundary of D. So if C is such a subset, Q D of C will give me the flux of that quantity through C. And then a balance law, you say that that quantity is balanced if for every D, the flux is balanced by the production in D. And in particular, you say that that quantity is conserved whenever the production vanishes. Okay, so this is what a balance law or a conservation law is in generality. Let me make some very simple assumptions on this additive set function. First of all, one of the assumptions is the following, that if you have two domains, let's say D1 and D2, that share part of their boundary, and to the same orientation, the same outward norm, let's say this is C, that it is shared by the boundaries of two domains, let's say D1 and D2, then the value of Q D1 at C is the same as the value of Q D2 at C. That's obvious. It's a natural sort of requirement. And another requirement, just to simplify the analysis, namely that, let's say, the size of the flux is bounded by the Hausdorff measure of C. Now, all these things appear to be a silly sort of abstraction and something that's very general. On the other hand, you can see exactly because it is so general, you expect that it will be satisfied under many different circumstances in physics, and certainly it is, as you know, many things are balanced in physics, mass, momentum, energy, electric field, etc., etc. What is amazing, however, is that this requirement here is extremely strong, a very strong restriction, so strong that, as you will see immediately, out of such a vague and general statement comes something that's very concrete. Okay. So the first theorem perhaps this strategy is write it here and then raise the blackboard. So the first theorem says the following. It says that, well, first, this depends on C only through the normal N. In other words, I'm a little bit disorganized at this point. I have to get better organized. Of course, as a consequence of that, you can see that you can write as an integral over C of a certain L infinity function defined on the boundary of B. Yes, C is a Borel subset of the boundary. So C is a subset of the boundary of D, and it is a Borel subset. Okay. And now the first theorem states that actually this function here depends on X, depends on D and X only through the unit normal N at the point X here. So the theorem says that there exists some function, let's call it AN of X, defined on the unit sphere in RK and omega and capital X here, with the property that is given by that, and this is for all n and for almost all x in script x. Moreover, this function here depends linearly over on n. So there exists an L infinity function defined on x such that and this is again almost everywhere, again for all n is k and almost everywhere. And finally, this function here satisfies a differential equation in the sense of distributions. So it's somewhat surprising. You start with very general assumptions here and somewhat vague about the nature of this set value functions. You end up with differential equation. And this result is actually very old. At least the idea of the proof of this result are very old. And the proof is essentially simple. You have to be a little bit careful about, of course, what p is and so on. But I will just draw here two pictures, and I will leave the proof as an exercise. I will be drawing the pictures as if k were equal to 2, because I'm not good in drawing higher dimensional pictures. But to prove, for instance, that the value of q at x may depend at only on the unit normal n, you can think of the following argument. So suppose you have two different domains, let's say d1 and another one d2, that share here this point x on their boundary and have the same unit normal here. So you have to prove that qd1 at this point x is equal to qd2 at this point x. So you just cut this thing with a ball that's centered at the point x, has small radius. You write the balance law for this domain here, and then for that domain. And you subtract. And you see, when you will subtract, you will see that you will end up with an equation that will involve, first of all, the production inside this domain here, and then the flux through that piece of the boundary, that piece of the boundary, and the two sides here. Now, think for a minute that p is absolutely continuous. So the size of the production in here is proportional to the volume, to the area of this domain here. On the other hand, the flux is proportional to the length of this of the boundary. So length goes to zero as r goes to zero, slower than the area. So the contribution of p becomes irrelevant. Also, when you look at the contribution along the boundary, these pieces of the boundary here, because the two curves are tangential there, is goes to zero much faster than the rest of the boundary. So this part of the boundary must balance out that part of the boundary. And this eventually leads you to the fact that q with respect to d1 at the point x is the same as q d2 at the same point there. And therefore, it depends only on the normal n. To prove this statement here, in two dimensions always, you just think of a small triangle like this and write the balance law for that small triangle, where this side here has unit normal n, and the other two sides are in the direction of the axis, let's say. So this is, let's say, n1, and this is n2. And now, if you write the balance law for this kind of triangle, and you let the triangle collapse into a point, again, you find out that necessarily this condition here should be satisfied. By the way, this argument was invented, was devised by Cauchy in 1822, so you can see how old this part is. Well, as I said, if you want to prove this result by under the assumptions that I've made here, and they are made for some reason, as you will see, not in order to be fancy, you have to be a little bit more careful. But the arguments are essentially what I had drawn here on the board. So this is the first remark, that you start with a statement that's very general, that it ought to be satisfied in many, many instances in mathematical physics, and you end up with here a system of differential equations. Let me make a few more remarks about this system here. Well, first of all, I claim that this special form, the fact that it's a system in divergence form, is preserved under change of coordinates. So suppose that I have here my x, and suppose that I consider a Bi-Lipschitz homeomorphism of my x into another domain here, x star. So it takes the point capital X to the point capital X star. I consider the Jacobian matrix of this transformation. This is a field, let's say, in L infinity. And let me make the assumption that the determinant of J is bounded almost everywhere away from zero. So this is for almost all X in capital X. Now I claim that the following is true. Suppose that I have fields A and P here. So let's say A is even, can be just an L infinity log of X. This takes values in, of course, it is a vector function, right? And I have P, which is a measure. And suppose that I now define A and star and P star on X star as follows. So A star is defined as, let's say, determinant J inverse, or A star with X star here is with X star, yes, this is determinant J inverse. And here I have A, and here I have J transpose. And also P star through this condition here, where then my claim is the following, that this equation is satisfied in the sense of distributions if and only if this equation holds in the sense of distributions. Of course, this is on X, and this is on X star. Again, tomorrow you will see that it's rather important to have this change of coordinates theorem here. How about proving this theorem? Now, if there are any graduate students present, I want to propose two different proofs. There are no graduate students present. Oh, there are some. All right. All right. So tomorrow he will bring me two proofs. So the first proof is the following. Assume that everything is here is differentiable, is continuously differentiable. The change of coordinates A and P are smooth. And then just make a computation. You know the change of variables here that I have suggested. Make the computation point-wise and prove that this equation here is equivalent to that equation. Okay? You will find out that this is a long and tedious calculation, but it's also an interesting calculation. You see, you have to differentiate this expression here, so you have to learn how to differentiate determinants, for instance. That's a good exercise for a graduate student, right? So this is one approach. It will take a couple of pages of calculation. Then there is a two-line proof. In other words, use the fact that what it means to have a weak solution of this equation here and see that this equation here weakly equivalent to that equation here. Right? And this change of variables will suggest how to pass from a test function for the first equation to a test function of the second equation. All right. Now, another issue that is, as you will see, related to that theorem here is the following. We have seen that starting from this rather general and vague statement of the balance law, we ended up with a differential equation. Now the question is whether we have lost anything in the process. In other words, suppose that I give you such a differential equation. Can you recover the balance law in its original form? Or more precisely, suppose that I give you A and a measure P, and that the divergence of A in the sensor distribution, A is just in L infinity here, if you see that the kind of assumptions that I have made on the function QD, this is in L infinity and this is in L infinity, so this is in L infinity with value on X. So the question is, can I recover from such an A, for instance, the function QD sub X that is defined on the boundary of every Lipschitz set D in capital X? So this is some kind of trace theorem. If, for instance, I knew that A is continuously differentiable. In that case, of course, P would be induced by continuous function. It's very easy to go back to Q sub D because Q sub D at the point X will just be A of X times N. However, when A is just in L infinity, the trace of A is not defined to the boundary of any such domain. So is it possible to go back? The answer is yes. The answer is that even though the trace of A of X is not generally defined on manifolds of codimension 1, this normal component of A is defined in a natural way. So here is a theorem. So suppose that A of X is, let's say, let me take the L infinity case. And suppose that the divergence of A is a measure P in the sensor distributions on X. And suppose that I take any D with Lipschitz bound. Then, the theorem says, there exists some function QD of the boundary of D such that if I take the integral of over the boundary of any D, I'm sorry. So this equation is satisfied for every test function phi with compact support in x. So you see, in particular, if you take phi to be identically to 1 on D, dying out outside of D, you're getting exactly this statement here that gives you the balanced law in its original form. Now, how do you prove this result? The oldest proof that I know is due to Anzelotti, and it's already about 20 years old. And it's a proof that, based on the Riesz representation theorem, you just prove that the right-hand side, you consider the right-hand side as a functional, as a linear functional, and you prove that it's bounded as a linear functional here, and therefore, Riesz representation will induce the existence of such a function. Okay? That's the job. The disadvantage of this approach, this is the shortest proof, but it does not tell you what Q sub D is. So given A, can I find Q sub D somehow? More recent proof is by Chen and Fried, a series of papers where they really construct explicitly QD by averaging A in a particular way. So they have to assume a little bit more on the boundary. They have to assume that the boundary is structured like that, can be more or less be thickened into a box. And then by writing the balance law inside a box of this type, and squeezing the box to get zero thickness in the limit, you end up with a representation formula for Q sub D. Now, once you know that simple theorem that I stated over there, on the other hand, there is another very, very quick proof. First, you prove the result for the case of a planar surface, where the proof is very, very simple. And then, by using such a change of variables, if you have any kind of surface here, you just Lipschitz surface, locally, you just map it into a planar surface, and from the planar, you're getting the proof for general Lipschitz boundary. Okay, so this is a way of proving this result, if you want. All right, so these are some generalities about balanced laws and conservation laws. From now on, I will be considering just conservation laws, but we'll have to use balanced laws later on. That's why I had to introduce them in the first place. Sure. Yes. The assumption is here. Yes. Once you make that assumption, then of course A will be an L infinity. No continuity assumption. You just make this assumption. It's almost obvious. I mean, if you think a little bit, this implies that this function is an L infinity. In fact, not only an L infinity, but bounded independently of D. This condition here implies that and this is for every x and for every d. Yes. It's not true? Yeah. Just such a measure. No. Right. By the way, Chen and Fried have proved much more sophisticated trace theorems, assuming, for instance, that A is just a measure. It's not real infinity, but it's just a measure, right? It turns out that this simple proof that I suggested works with A in any LP, but for P equals 1, it gets much more technical. And for measure, it gets, again, one level of magnitude more technical. Yes, yes, yes. That's right. Yes, yes. It's the value of the measure against a continuous function. Yes. Two C. Continuous functions. Or rather, the other way around. But. Sure. So, for instance, through this approach, that's right. So, for this approach, for instance, a possibility would have been to approach in the following way. You have to do it for this particular boundary. You have been assuming that you can deform somehow that boundary. Now, for almost all such curves, this thing will hold. And then you pass to the limit in, let's say, L infinity. Weak star, L1 weak star, or something like that, right? And you end up with the limit. That's, you could have done it that way as well. Yes, exactly. Okay, I'm sorry. My intention was to go very fast through these things that are important, however, as you will see next time, for very concrete reasons. So let me go to the next step. So suppose that I have a conservation law of this type. So A is a function of x here. This equation is satisfied in the sense of distributions. And A here is a vector field, or a matrix with a single row matrix. Now I want to consider systems of conservation laws. And that simply means that instead of M1, I have n such equations. So capital A now will be taking values in the space of n by k matrices, right? So this is a system of conservation laws. And of course, when such systems arise in mechanics and physics, the objective is to determine A. But here, if you count, of course, the number of equations and unknowns, you can see that this problem here is underdetermined. You don't have enough information to determine A. So you need additional information. And for class of problems in mechanics, in physics, electrodynamics, this additional information is introduced in the form of so-called constitutive assumptions. So a constitutive assumption which more or less determines the nature of the medium that I consider in the physical problem. Tomorrow we shall see concrete examples, and this will become clearer what is the physical interpretation of constitutive assumptions. But constitutive assumption means that this A at the point x, the value of A at x is determined by the value of a certain vector field, capital U, at the point x. So you have some function g of u. U takes values here in Rn. G is a function taking values in n minus k, but n cross k, and that's known to you. Okay. So if you know u, you can find a. So you substitute into this equation and you end up with a system that is now at least formally closed. So this is the kind of systems that the theory tries to study. Okay? This is the goal of the theory, study systems of that time. You see the system of n equations in n unknowns, namely the n components of U. So when I will talk about a system of conservation laws, I will mean systems of this form. G is given, but typically nonlinear. U is my unknown. Now, let's see that I have the... A very important concept here in the theory is the concept of so-called companion conservation law. So you say that you have a companion to this system here if you can find a vector field B of U. So this takes place in Rn with the property, let me make sure I don't make a mistake with the matrix notation, and you can find some function here, Q of U. So this takes values in M K cross 1 with the property that now, why is this relevant? What is the motivation of this definition? You see that if indeed you can find such a function Q, then any C1U that satisfies this system here satisfies automatically, identically, an additional conservation law, namely this one. This is just the chain rule here. You will see that this really is the heart of the theory, the presence of the possibility that companion conservation laws may be present, and you will see what role they do play in the theory. Let me just make the comment that, of course, if U is just an L infinity function, for instance, for which this equation is satisfied in the sense of distributions, it is no longer true that this will be equal to zero. Right? The chain rule, the product rule, and so on, no longer apply in that sense. So this, you will see, will play a very important role. However, you will see that physics motivates additional conditions, namely, for certain companion conservation laws, it is required that even though for weak solutions of the original system of conservation laws, this is not zero, this is at least less equal than zero. It has a definite sign. You will see that this is related very much with the second law of thermodynamics in physics. Notice that if this is less equal than zero, then the right-hand side, let's say for L infinity U, will necessarily be a measure. It will be a distribution of a definite sign, and therefore a measure. And therefore, in that case, we do have a balanced law. We can appeal to all the theorems that I have stated for balanced laws. So even though it's not exactly zero, if it has a definite sign, it still induces a balanced law. but for the time being, let's stay to this. So it's important, if you're given such a system, to try to identify all possible companion conservation laws. Now, of course, you can trivially construct such conservation laws by taking any linear combination of G here. But these are trivial. These are just, and the resulting equations here are just linear combinations of this equation here. It does not give us any new information. So I'm interested in situations in which these are non-trivial. So in particular, I'm interested, if possible, in situations in which this function here is, locally at least, a diffeomorphism from, let's say, domain of Rn to the domain of Rn. Right. Now, let me see. Yeah, I think I can give a little bit more detail here. Alright, so in order to write down the condition, you just write the integrability conditions that are associated with this equation here. You see the integrability conditions are that if I take and now here, if you count the number of equations and you count the number of unknowns, the unknowns are just the components of B here. You have just n unknowns, but if you count the number of equations, you find out that this system is hopelessly overdetermined. So if I were to give you an arbitrary system of conservation laws, the probability that you will be able to find a companion conservation law would be zero. On the other hand, notice that there are some systems for which such conservation laws obviously exist. For instance, suppose that the system is symmetric. You say that your system here is symmetric. If the gradients of these functions here are symmetric. And you see that when the system is symmetric, such a companion conservation law exists, because you can take, for instance, B of U to be the identity, and the integrability condition certainly holds. In fact, it's also easy to find in this case what the Qs are. This condition here will tell me, of course, that let me keep my notation straight. This will tell me that G of U will be derivative of some scalar function gamma of U, and it turns out that in this case Q of U will just be so symmetric. Systems are endowed with a non-trivial companion conservation law. But actually the, yeah? This. This is the integrability condition associated with this statement here. Okay, so it turns out that conversely, if you have a system of conservation laws that is endowed with a non-trivial companion conservation law, non-trivial in the sense that B of u is a diffeomorphism. Then if you change variables, if you change your vector u into u star, which is B of u, you end up with a system which is symmetric. This is a very old result, observation by Godunov, Friedrichs, and Lax. So the systems that are endowed with a non-trivial companion conservation law are exactly the systems that are symmetrizable. They're either symmetric or you can change variables in such a way that they become symmetric. Okay? You will see how useful it is to have a companion conservation law. All right? Still another somewhat changing direction for a few minutes. A very important question in the theory of conservation laws, a very important factor in the theory of conservation laws, is the existence of so-called shock fronts. So a shock front is a special type of solution of the following type. You have, let's say, a weak solution of such a system in some domain here, let's say, chi, with the following geometric structure. Embedded in chi, you have, let's say, a smooth manifold of codimension 1, let's call it F, and it's oriented with the help of its unit normal, so you have, let's say, the positive side and the negative side of that manifold. And you assume that the function u is C1 everywhere except across this manifold here. And moreover, as one approaches any point here on the manifold, let's say from the negative side, u approaches certain limit, let's say u minus. If you approach the same point from the other side, you approach another limit, u plus. So you ask the question, what condition should be satisfied by such a u in order to be a weak solution of this equation here? Now, it's very easy to solve this problem. Of course, away from the manifold, u, very smooth, it will satisfy, of course, the equation in the classical sense. So the question is, what additional conditions should be satisfied at points here in the manifold? And it's easy to see what happens if you just blow up the coordinates. You see that everything here is homogeneous, so I can change x by ax. I will map solutions into solutions, in which case, locally, this will be mapped into some kind of function which is constant equal to u minus on the one side of a plane of hyperplane here with unit normal n and u plus on the other side. And then it's a simple exercise to study under what conditions is this a weak solution of that equation. It turns out that the condition is the following, that the jump of G in the direction n should vanish. So the question is, given G, are there any, is there a possibility of shock fronts? And what would be the geometric structure of shock fronts? Or at least of shock fronts of small strength. So small strength means that the jump from u minus to u plus is sufficiently small. Okay? Now, it is clear that you can rewrite this condition in the following form. integral from 0 to 1, let's say, here you have dg of tau u plus 1 minus tau u minus, and then you have here n, sorry, d tau, this operating on the jump of u. So this symbol here just means u plus minus u minus is equal to 0. I can rewrite this equation in that form. And this suggests the importance of looking at the following variety. For any u in Rn, you look at the variety of nv. So here n is just a direction in space, unit vector, and v is something that satisfies the condition . You look at this variety, and depending on how rich this variety is, you can, of course, guess how rich the possibility of having shock fronts is. So, for instance, suppose that this variety is trivial, it's impossible to have shock fronts. In that case, your system is exactly elliptic. So this is a characterization of ellipticity for the system. So elliptic systems are exactly the systems for which shock fronts of small amplitude are impossible. Okay. The other extreme, the highest possibility of having shock fronts are the hyperbolic systems that I will introduce next time. But then you have many situations between the elliptic and the hyperbolic case. Such shock fronts appear very often in physics. Of course, in dynamics, in hyperbolic conservation laws, they correspond to so-called shock waves. And we shall see those next time. But they appear also in the context of equilibrium, for instance, when you are dealing with media that are undergoing phase transitions. So in that case, the shock fronts, what I call here a shock front, is a phase boundary. Is a boundary between the two phases of your material. Right? And always, of course, this condition here is satisfied. In the case of the hyperbolic case, these conditions are called the Rankine-Ygoniot conditions. We shall see those tomorrow. However, to finish my lecture today, I want to give you an example that will explain why the presence of shock fronts means trouble. Analytically. So suppose that I'm dealing with such a system for which shock fronts are possible. So I assume that I have, let's say, two states, let's say V and W, such that for some n, some direction in space. Okay? Now I can construct highly oscillatory solutions of the system in Rk. In other words, start with any family of parallel hyperplanes, all of them normal to n. Construct a function u, which is equal to takes values v and w in alternating order here between the successive hyperplanes. So this function u is a weak solution of this system here, by what I said before. Okay. Now, by just arranging this system, these hyperplanes, you can construct a sequence of such solutions that converge weak star to any function of that varies any way you wish between V and W. Okay? Of course, that function, which will be the limit of a sequence of solutions of that system here, will no longer be a solution of this system. Not necessarily, unless G happens to be affine, let's say, along the straight line that joins V and W. But for a general G, so whenever you have the possibility of shock fronts, weak limits of solutions are not necessarily solutions. So that is what makes hyperbolic problems difficult. In elliptic problems, as you know, weak limits, weakly convergent sequences of solutions converge to solutions typically. But in hyperbolic problems, this is not the case at all. Now, let me give you a first indication of the possible stabilizing role of companion conservation laws. Suppose that my system is endowed with a non-trivial companion conservation law, and let me make the assumption that for some physical reasons, I have to assume that good solutions of my system should satisfy not only the system of conservation laws, but also an inequality of this type. Now, suppose that V and W have this property, which of course will generically be satisfied if indeed Q is non-trivial. Then these highly oscillatory solutions are no longer admissible solutions. They don't satisfy this condition here. Because once I assume, I make that assumption, you can jump from V to W or from W to V, but not the other way around. Is this clear? So somehow the presence of such an inequality stabilizes at least these highly oscillatory solutions. Of course, things may oscillate in a much crazier way than I have pointed out here. And the question is such an inequality sufficient to rule out all possible crazy oscillations of the system? And this question is still open in generality. Perhaps you have heard of the method of compensated compactness that tries exactly to draw out of the presence of such inequalities a theorem that the limit of weak solutions, weakly convergent sequence of solutions, actually converts to solutions of our system. But the way this method applies, at least with the tools we have today, it applies only when you have a rather large family of such inequalities. Now, from the point of view of physics, only one inequality is provided to you. And of course, this is one of the limitations of the method of compensated compactness at the present time. So this is a very important question. Another important question is the following. Suppose that you have such a system, and suppose that the system may have solutions in the form of shock fronts. Suppose you have a solution that it is a weak solution. Can you say that all the singularities of that solution are of this nature? Okay. Now, there are situations in which the function class itself, in which the solutions exist, dictates that all possible singularities should be of that type. And this is, for instance, the case where U is a function of class BV, because BV functions have this structure that automatically all their singularities lie on manifolds of codimension 1. They're not smooth manifolds here, it's finite perimeter and so on, but in any case. In that case, you can very easily see that all these surfaces of singularities are exactly the shock fronts. However, I think that it would be fair to conjecture that hyperbolicity itself dictates that all singularities should be of that nature here. And in fact, there is a very interesting theorem, very recent result, by Delellis. And I think it's with Ambrosio. Is it with Ambrosio? I think it's with Ambrosio. That tells us exactly that for scalar conservation laws, where n equals 1, when you're dealing with good solutions, all possible singularities, L infinity, in the class of L infinity functions, assemble themselves automatically on manifolds of codimension 1. So this is an important first step towards proving that for general systems of hyperbolic conservation laws, singularities somehow assemble themselves on surfaces of dimension 1, which is something that's worth proving. So sorry, today I was somewhat disorganized, but tomorrow I will be more focused. I will consider more specific facts, and then you will see how all these elements that I introduced today come into play to give us something more concrete.